29 in Manchester and Keene. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The story from Algeria this morning is changing rapidly as more information comes in about a hostage taking yesterday at an internationally operated gas facility. Islamic militants reportedly took as many as 100 hostages, though the numbers are unclear at this point. The group behind the attack says it's in retaliation for French military actions in Mali against Islamist forces there. The Algerian situation reflects a growing terrorist threat from Africa. Many U.S. analysts fear terrorist groups, including those affiliated with Al-Qaeda, are becoming more active and powerful on the continent, presenting a renewed threat to the United States. Our guest today in The Exchange has been watching these developments and reporting on them for National Public Radio. We're talking with Dina Temple-Raston, NPR's national security correspondent. She's in New Hampshire this week, kicking off a new lecture series called Justice and Journalism, presented by NHPR and the UNH School of Law. Temple-Raston has looked at how these conflicts abroad affect security at home. She's also reported on domestic terrorism debates, from FBI sting operations aimed at potential terrorists to President Obama's unfulfilled promise to close Guantanamo Bay. These are all counterterrorism challenges that the administration faces as it prepares for a second term. And that's what we're discussing this hour with Dina Temple-Raston. Let's hear from you, too. What would you put on that list of national security or counterterrorism priorities for the president's next 4 years? How well do you think the White House has, so far, handled these threats? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And again, NPR's Dina Temple-Raston, their counterterrorism correspondent, is with us in studio. Dina, nice to see you again. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, this story from Algeria is clearly unfolding. It's hard to get an exact picture of what's going on. But what are you hearing this morning, Dina, either from your trusted sources or your editors at NPR?
Well, from some phone calls I made this morning, there's something going on the ground right there, right now. It's unclear what it is. It's unclear whether or not the Algerians have started strafing the plant. It's unclear whether they've stormed the plant, but there's some sort of action going on. There's some reports there that say that the hostages have actually been killed in this. I'm hearing from my sources that there's so much confusion on the ground that they would sort of pause and say, we shouldn't go with that kind of story yet.
Yeah. So, and some hostages, clearly Americans and Westerners. We do know that.
Yes. We also heard that some escaped last night. But there is a real, as I say, things are moving so quickly on the ground. It's far away. And the Algerians are taking the lead on this. So I think that we're getting a lot of information, not just secondhand, but third hand and fourth hand. So it's a very fluid situation. And I would say until this sort of calms down, the reports you hear are probably not going to be very accurate.
Right. And I was looking at some of them this morning, and they were wildly different numbers just on the number of hostages,
right,
for example. That's no one's fault. It's just that it's tricky.
Well, the reason why the number of hostages keeps changing is because this is a very big facility, and nobody wants to tell the terrorists exactly how many people are in the facility that are unaccounted for. So let's say, for example, they say that there are seven Americans, and in fact, the terrorists are holding only two. They know they need to comb through the facility and find the other five.
Ah, I see.
So that's the reason why the numbers are being kept secret.
How significant is it, Dina, that these militants have attacked an internationally owned gas facility? What does this say about, you know, American presence, Western presences in other countries?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Everybody's saying that this was such a surprise that they attacked this facility. And I don't think it should have been a surprise at all. They needed a target of opportunity that would get them a lot of publicity and press. This particular facility is only 37 miles from the border with Libya. A lot of people are saying these are people that came in from Mali. There is a lot of indication that these are, in fact, terrorists who came in from Libya. And 37 miles is not a very long distance. So it's not that surprising in that respect. I think that you're going to be seeing a lot of these kinds of facilities, which are vulnerable, to be sure, beefing up their security. And these are hard facilities to actually secure. And that's one of the things that the American military is looking at now. If there was going to be an American military operation, they needed to figure out how hard or easy it was to defend the plant.
Yeah, it's interesting. You used a term, target of opportunity.
Right.
What does that mean exactly?
Target of opportunity is basically something that's easy for them to do, more bang for the buck, right? So embassies used to be targets of opportunity. They're not anymore. Hotels are often targets of opportunity. When I was in Pakistan, one of the things that we were warned against is actually going to work out in the gyms of major hotels. Because if you are going to be a terrorist, the first thing you do if you want to target Americans is to go down to the gym and shoot it up. And in fact, at one point in Karachi, I decided I hadn't worked out in so long. I was dying for a run. So I went down to the gym it's a major hotel in Karachi. And I looked around, and there were 25 Americans in there. So I ran about a mile and thought, you know, this just really
isn't
worth it.
Yeah, it's not worth it. I'll get it running when
I
get home.
Left, yeah.
And we should let the audience know you just got back from Pakistan just about a week ago and joined us again last night in Concord, kicking off the Justice and Journalism Lecture Series hosted by NHPR and UNH Law. So we really appreciate you being here, given that you just got off the plane practically from Pakistan. A couple more questions about this Algeria and connected Mali situation. These are places, Dino, with which many Americans are not familiar. How does that complicate your storytelling about what's happening and about how severe these developments might be for us here in the United States?
Well, I think it's not as difficult as you would first believe, because these are sort of obscure places. But what my purview is and my beat is really Al-Qaeda. And I understand Al-Qaeda and the way it works together with its affiliate groups, works with big Al-Qaeda, as we say, or core Al-Qaeda. And, you know, the things that have been going on in Mali, this has been a concern for some time. And I know about the various insurrections in these various places only because Al-Qaeda is always trying to fill a vacuum. So as soon as we see some place that has some sort of vacuum, Yemen, Somalia, until recently, and Mali, you know that Al-Qaeda is going to try and fill that space. Same thing happened in Nigeria as well. There's a group there called Boko Haram, which is linking itself up with Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda is a very opportunistic organization, and we're seeing that now in Mali.
Yeah, and that leads into my next question. I mean, again, most people who aren't tracking this as closely as you are might wonder, why these places now? You know, Mali, Algeria.
Well, in Mali's case, in March, there was a coup, and there had already been some movement with AQIM taking over parts of Mali. They were working with a rebel or an independence group there called the Tuaregs, which is a tribe that's wanted independence for some time. And they just took advantage of that situation. The Tuaregs got together with the Islamists and said, let's fight the government and, you know, create a homeland, thinking, as many groups do, we'll invite the Islamists to leave after we get our homeland. And what ended up happening instead is that the Islamists pushed the Tuaregs out. And they became sort of the number one operating entity in a part, basically a part of northern Mali that's about as big as Texas. So it's a fair amount of land. At the same time, the really, really big turning point here, and even when Libya first fell, people were talking about this. There were so many arms in Libya. Muammar Gaddafi had so many arms. And as soon as he fell, there was an amazing arms bazaar. Everybody got all kinds of arms. And Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has for years been sort of the black sheep of the Al-Qaeda family. AQIM, as it's known, was basically this operation that was almost a criminal operation. They were doing lots and lots of kidnappings. They ran guns. They ran cigarettes. They ran drugs to the point where they were seen as the black sheep by Al-Qaeda core. They were basically saying, look, you're doing things that we don't feel are with our, you know, jihadi virtuous mission, as they see it. And this went on for some time, that AQIM was sort of the black sheep, until Al-Qaeda started running out of money. And AQIM had plenty of money to give Al-Qaeda. And so they were given a little bit more quarter because basically they had this cash. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb then took all that money and, first of all, helped fund the Tuaregs in Mali. But they also bought a lot of the guns that were coming out of Libya. And I think I said earlier that one of the concerns, AQIM is the group they think is inside this BP plant. One of the concerns is some of the guns that they bought were these surface-to-air missiles, and that could take down a helicopter. These are things that were not very prevalent in Africa before the fall of Libya. So you have sort of a mix of vacuum, and you have a mix of arms that were never really able to be on the market. I'm trying to remember what the numbers were, but the way they knew that Libyan arms were flooding the African market is that an AK-47 used to cost about $100 on the black market. And then the price of the AK-47 went down to something like between $25 and $40.
Wow.
I might have the numbers slightly off.
But a big drop.
And this is, if you wonder how do you know arms are flooding a market, that's how you know. The price is essentially cut in half.
And it's surface-to-air missiles, highly concerning. It doesn't even need to be said for American forces, British forces, French forces, whoever
for
might
any,
be
anybody.
There.
I mean, it completely changes the game because all you need then, if you have a surface-to-air missile, is to be standing outside an airport. I mean, this was always the concern that somehow surface-to-air missiles would be, for example, outside an airport in Kenya and shoot down an American plane.
Yeah, lots of tourists.
Not to sort of whip up all kinds of fear, but this is clearly a different kind of weapon than if you have an AK-47.
You know, what you said about, in response to my question, why now, that this has been developing for a long time. You said earlier Al-Qaeda loves to fill in a vacuum. You wrote in a recent story, Dina, that the Arab Spring hasn't turned out quite the way American counterterrorism officials had hoped. What were the hopes when this sort of, it seemed like democracy, power to the people, freedom, a couple years back? Americans were excited about the Arab Spring. They thought, wow, this is going to be great. This country, these regions will no longer be interested in terrorism. They'll all be just, building democracy and peace and love and so forth. And you've written a lot lately that it hasn't quite worked out that way.
No, it's interesting because the people I talk to tend to be a little more pessimistic about things.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as the Arab Spring happened, a lot of people, not necessarily people I agree with, were saying, see, Al-Qaeda is dead. Al-Qaeda had said for so long, if you want some sort of Muslim-led government, if you don't want despots, you have to do what we do, which is violent overthrow.
Arm struggle.
Violent overthrow. So as a result, when the Arab Spring happened and it was relatively peaceful, the idea was that it had completely killed Al-Qaeda's narrative. And the pessimist that I talked to, and I felt this way too, is that if things didn't work out the way people had planned, in other words, if Egypt, for example, didn't have a smooth transition and all the things that the people in the square were hoping to have, they didn't get, Al-Qaeda would say, see, you need violence. You can't do it in a peaceful way. And that seems to have been what happened.
After a short break, Dina, we'll start focusing on how all this might affect the counterterrorism challenges that President Obama faces in his second term. We'll take your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more with NPR reporter Dina Temple-Raston on The Exchange and at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, Air Pollution in China. NHPR is more than our daily broadcast. Check out our website to listen back to a story you might have missed or only caught a part of. Find more information or related stories about something that interests you. Subscribe to podcasts, learn about special events. There's always something more at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, hosting an information session for their Doctorate of Education program on February 9th. Information at nec.edu. And from Steiner Law Office, supporting Leadership New Hampshire, a 10-month program fostering civil discourse and civic engagement, now accepting applications at leadershipnh.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston is with us. We're looking at some of the new and emerging counterterrorism challenges that the Obama administration is facing as it prepares to begin its next 4 years. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. What would you put on that list of counterterrorism or national security priorities for the president's next 4 years? How well do you think this White House has handled the latest threats, some of which we've talked about this morning? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Dina, just before the break, we were talking about how the Arab Spring hasn't worked out as some more optimistic analysts had hoped, that it would flower democracy and freedom throughout the Middle East and North Africa, and that the terrorist threat would wane, Al-Qaeda would be on the run and so forth. And as you described, hasn't quite worked out that way. So how does the Obama administration then approach this changing and less hopeful turn of events, Stina?
Well, I think the whole national security picture is changing in not just because of the Arab Spring, but more broadly because with the drone policy that the Obama administration has pursued, basically the entire top tier of al-Qaeda is dead, with the exception of Zawahiri, who was bin Laden's replacement. And now the drone program seems to have taken out most of its middle management as well. So if you've done that, and the entire idea behind military action is that the U.S. was fighting a war against al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda is largely decimated, what do you do after that? And clearly, in the next 4 years, the Obama administration is going to address that. There's already been some murmurings about this. Jay Johnson, who has just stepped down as the top counsel at the Department of Defense, gave a speech in Britain a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it was longer than that. Maybe a month ago. That basically he said, what is the U.S. going to do in terms of its detainee policy and its drone policy after something called the AUMF no longer applies? That's the authorization for military force. It was basically an open-ended authorization that Congress gave to President Bush in literally the days after 9/11, in which he said, do what you need to do to knock out al-Qaeda.
War on terror, open-ended.
Right. They don't call it the war on terror anymore, but basically the war on al-Qaeda. Okay. You do what you need to do, which is essentially the fig leaf or the law, depending on how you look at it, that the Obama administration has been using to have drone policy in Yemen, to have drone policy in Pakistan, and to basically, you could even say, go and get Osama bin Laden as well. It's all under, self-defense and whatever was authorized under the AUMF. So now, as we get to the waning days of this particular conflict, they are going to have to find a different legal mechanism and structure that allows them to do the things that they're doing today. Because clearly al-Qaeda isn't done. We see this in the BP attack. We see this in Libya, although al-Qaeda had a very, very minor role in the Benghazi attack. But clearly it's still rearing its head and it's still trying to get stronger. So if you don't have an authorization to use military force, what legal framework do you use, for example, to keep people at Guantanamo? What legal framework do you use to say we have the right to shoot drones in other countries? And these are the kinds of things that the Obama administration is going to have to deal with in the next 4 years. And they're going to have to deal with them with governments that aren't entirely sure where they stand on it. So what is the Muslim Brotherhood going to say about that? I think they knew what Mubarak would have said, but it's a little unclear what the Muslim Brotherhood would say. What about Tunisia? What about all these? What about Mali? What about Somalia? We have now a president there who seems to have a handle on things and can actually govern. In fact, I think he's in the United States now, and the U.S. has just re-recognized Somalia after more than a decade. But these are all sort of morphing in a way that is very unpredictable. And as a result, the Obama administration is going to have to be very nimble about this.
So they not only have to come up with a military strategy, but also a legal strategy.
I'd reverse the order of those. Yeah.
You mentioned the drone strikes, Dina. Has there been a drone strike backlash in some of these countries where, sure, you take out some al-Qaeda leadership, but you also upset and anger a lot of people at the same time?
It's really unclear how much the backlash is. It sort of depends on where you stand when it comes to drone policy. It seems if you're against drones, the people you talk to all hate them. And it seems if you think drones is an effective policy, there's more gray area there. And a perfect example would be Pakistan. Nobody has actually, in terms of people like me, journalists, have not gone to ground and actually where there has been a strike. Miriam Shah, we're not allowed to go in that area. It's a no-go zone for the Pakistanis. If you go there and talk to people in the village, how will they really respond? Well, if you speak to Ahmed, who lost his uncle and is 10 years old, he probably is really upset. If you speak to Ahmed's mother, who is scared to go out to get food because the Taliban won't let a woman go out unaccompanied in her village, she might have a different view. I'm not coming down either way on drone policy. I'm just saying it's very hard for us to figure out where the local people are on it. And what we're hearing from Pakistan largely has to do with the elite and what the elite say. And they have a completely legitimate sovereignty argument there. I don't think anybody disagrees that there's a sovereignty argument there. But those are not people who are on the front lines dealing with the Taliban. They're in the cities where the Taliban may be, but in fact are not affecting their lives in any real way. I think it's highly, you know, one of the things nobody talks about when we talk about drones, and I hope to cover this more, is sort of this sort of PTSD effect that drones are having in Pakistan. I'm hearing from people there that, in fact, the constant, they make a sort of whirring sound, and that constant sort of hum lets people in the villages know that the drones are there, and they never know when there's going to be a Hellfire missile fired. So you can imagine that if you're on pins and needles all the time, that this has a terrifically bad effect.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's something that, you know, so maybe you don't need to have a drone actually shoot a missile and kill your uncle. Maybe you just need to have that constant hum and that constant concern that something could come out of the sky and blow you up.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned last night at our talk at UNH School of Law that it was real interesting to you that the Pakistani military had not shot down more of these drones. You said these things are slow and sluggish, and it was interesting to you that they haven't taken as much action against these as...
Well, I'd amend that just a little bit to say they have not shot down any drone, not more, none. They have shot down not one drone, and they're pretty slow. And in
so
addition,
if they wanted
to,
they could.
One would think. The other part of but it shows some division in Pakistan. I mean, if they were so hard over against the drones, this shows some division. Also, they've never sort of formally provided a resolution in the United Nations demanding that the drones stop. That's also highly significant. You know, as long as the drones are targeting people that the Pakistanis don't like either, I think they're absolutely fine with the drone program. And then when there are some casualties, which have been less and less, but when there are some civilian casualties, they get upset, and rightly so. And I think that's I think it's a lot grayer than people think it is.
Yeah.
And we have the tendency, I think, to put people in our shoes instead of being in other people's shoes. And I believe that if we had drone strikes here in the United States, we would go crazy about it. But we have a completely different environment than what's going on in Pakistan. And a lot of the people who are in these towns that the Taliban has overrun really want the Taliban gone. And the drone policy, my understanding is, has been very, very effective at basically pushing them out of a lot of areas. And as a result, they're sort of cornered in Miriam Shah, which is where most of the drone strikes are now.
Yeah. And Dean, I want to take some calls, and then I have one more question about this drone policy. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number here on the exchange for you to join us with Dina Temple-Raston, again, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, is with us in studio today. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Mike's waiting in Lebanon. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a editor, former reporter. And there are times when dealing with the police, they ask you not to put something in the paper because of an ongoing investigation. And sometimes you comply and sometimes you don't. I had my notes subpoenaed once. That was exciting. But I'm thinking when you're dealing with terrorism, there's got to be some of that as well. I'm thinking of two examples. One is they revealed that one of the ways they found Osama, confirmed him, was by having nurses doing polio checks. And within a few weeks, we had polio nurses in Pakistan being murdered by terrorists. The other thing is that I think some of the confusion in Benghazi was because the White House appeared to be trying to come up with an explanation that didn't reveal that the consulate was actually kind of a major spook shop. And I just wonder what constraints you're under and how you make these judgments of what you're going to tell and what you're not going to tell.
Yeah, Mike, it's a great question. Thank you for calling. Go ahead, Dina.
Well, if I can tweak your question a little bit, because there's some factual issues. The first is that, in fact, the CIA had tried to use a doctor and a nurse to try and get DNA from the children that were in the Osama bin Laden compound. And they said not that it was polio vaccines, but it was some other kind of vaccine that they were offering. And depending on who you talk to, there's supposed to be a report that comes out of Pakistan on their Abbottabad commission. They say that a nurse did get DNA and that the U.S. knew definitively that bin Laden was in there. The U.S. has said that project never happened. It was not a few weeks later that polio workers were targeted in Pakistan. I mean, I was in Pakistan when that happened, and I reported on that story, and that was a month ago. So it was 18 months later. So it's not really cause and effect. And even before the CIA operation that may have used this doctor to get the DNA. And I think everybody agrees that was sort of a bad idea, because health workers do need to be in these countries and be above that sort of suspicion, just like journalists need to be above that sort of suspicion. But there had always been some concern about vaccination programs in Pakistan in particular. What I understood was that extremist Muslims have always said that vaccination programs were actually a way to sterilize Muslims, and it was a plot the West had to sterilize Muslims and basically wipe them off the face of the earth. This is a narrative that has been used by extremist Muslims in Pakistan for years, way before the CIA operation. So that's one part of it. In the Benghazi part of it, I still think there's a lot of confusion about what's going on in Benghazi, because we had our reporter there. I'm fairly certain Layla Fadl was the one who was there like within a day. And she actually talked to someone who said they were a protester. So there's a lot of confusion about Benghazi. Were they trying to cover up that this was a big spook operation in Libya? And in fact, what they were doing is they were trying to chase all these weapons that we're now seeing sort of pop up in Mali and in Algeria now. Were they trying to sort of cover that up? Yeah, I think they were to a certain extent. But the way that story unfolded, and I was reporting it very heavily for NPR with lots of my sources, and the way that story unfolded is the same way that most terrorism attacks unfold. You know, there's an understanding of what's going on in the beginning, and then that gets refined as you try and look more closely at what happened and who was behind it. And the stories change. And I think if Benghazi had happened when we weren't sort of 3 months before an election, I think it would have been seen a little bit differently. And I'm not sure it would have been seen in quite the political context it was in. I mean, your broader question is, do we often have to keep things, as you did when you were a reporter, do we have to keep things secret sometimes? Yes, we do. I do. I mean, for example, just this latest incident, you know, there are some reporters, me included, who think we know that what the actual number of Americans there is. The reason we haven't reported that number is because if they're holding two and I say they're seven, they'll go in search of the other five.
Right, as you said earlier.
I don't think that's a very difficult thing to keep quiet.
Mike, thank you very much for the call. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. With Dina Temple-Raston, we're looking at some of the possible counterterrorism challenges facing the Obama administration in the next 4 years. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Dina, earlier we were talking about the drone strikes, and I did want to ask you one more question related to the administration again, starting up its second term. Do you think the Obama administration will continue drone strikes in the second term? You talked about how they're kind of looking at this, reevaluating this.
Yeah, I guess when I talk about reevaluation, I'm actually talking much more in terms of the legal structure that will allow them to continue to do it. I think that they've decided that drones work really well. I think that there are drones that are the size of mosquitoes now. So this is the way of the future. And I think that what the Obama administration is very cognizant of is that they're not going to be the only people with drones. There are lots of drones out there. There are lots of other countries that will use drones. And unless there is some sort of legal framework that allows everybody to do it using the same rules, and the U.S. has to lead the way on this, we're going to have a real problem with drones. And I think that is more of the motivation. It's not that the policy is going to change. It's that the law needs to catch up with the policy.
You know, one critique that I have heard from counterterrorism experts, national security folks who come through our doors, is that the Obama administration's general counterterrorism strategy isn't that different from the Bush administration. I wonder what you think, Dina.
It isn't. Well, there's Bush 1 and Bush 2. George W. Bush first term, George W. Bush second term. Second term, they ratcheted back quite a bit of stuff. So I think that's about right. Actually, I think that the torture and the enhanced interrogation, that sort of thing, was going on in Bush 1, but not Bush 2. I think that there's always been this difference between campaigning and reality, right? And when you campaign, there are lots of things you hope you can do.
I'm going to close Guantanamo Bay.
Okay. And you think it's possible. And then when you actually dig into it, you realize that it's actually a lot more complicated than you thought. I mean, in the case of Guantanamo Bay, and I cover Guantanamo for us, and in fact, I'm going next month for the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed hearings down to Guantanamo. I think the problem was that the Obama administration thought this was a great idea. They signed a declaration that said that it would be closed in a year. But they hadn't really sort of lined up all the political capital that they needed to get it done. And they lost that opportunity. And then what ended up happening is that Congress went hard over the other way and basically made it almost impossible for the Obama administration to close Guantanamo by making it impossible to transfer detainees even to a third country, by making it impossible to try detainees in the United States. And then the military commission system, which has been reformed, even though a lot of people still have problems with it, it's glacial, absolutely glacial. The opening statements for the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial, which was just sort of basically to bring the charges against them, it took 14 hours. I was there for all 14. And, part of that was because the system is trying to sort of find itself. Part of that is they're trying to be very, very careful that they don't have anything that can be used later for appeal. And part of that is that there were five guys in court and they were acting out a bit. Now, arraignments, that's the word I was looking for. Arraignments can take 10 minutes sometimes. Sometimes they can take hours. It wasn't quite the circus that everybody painted it to be, because I thought that the antics that happened and the objections and everything else that was there really took place over 14 hours. So if that had taken place in 2 hours, then it would have been a circus. But over 14 hours, it just
starts to drag.
Yeah, exactly. So, CNN and I think actually used the word circus. And I didn't find it circus-like. I actually thought that the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the four other guys there were canny in the way that they just sort of disrupted, not all the time, but just occasionally there was a punctuation of disruption. And I thought it showed how well they understood the system and how much they knew they could get away with. And they did. Nobody removed them from the courtroom.
Real quickly, Dina, before our break, is it a goal of the Obama administration for the second term to close Guantanamo once and for all?
My theory is yes. But I don't know exactly how they're going to do it because there's a lot of legal wrangling there. But I know it's something that Eric Holder, the attorney general, really wants to do. And my theory is that is why he signed on for a second term, because he wants to finish that job.
All right. We'll take more of your calls after a short break. So if you're on the phone, stay there. We'll be right back. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Groponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Groponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at Groponi.com. And from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at NHHEAF.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
What's new at NHPR? Well, there's TED.
TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design.
Innovators from all disciplines giving the talks of their lives in 18 minutes. That's coming to our weekend lineup. Plus, you can start the week off right, too, with Political Front.
She's going to need to forge that fellow feeling among the legislature to
get
things
done. Our senior political
gone.
Reporter Josh Rogers brings us up to speed on the statewide political landscape on Monday mornings. More about all our new programs at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston. She's in New Hampshire this week helping kick off the new Justice and Journalism lecture series hosted by NHPR and UNH Law. We're looking at some of the emerging national security counterterrorism challenges facing the Obama administration in the next 4 years. And we invite your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. What would you put on that list of national security priorities
for the administration as it faces a second term? And how would you say the president has handled national security, counterterrorism threats in his first term? Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And Dina, let's go right back to our listeners. Todd's waiting in Walpole. Hi, Todd. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Can you hear me?
Sure can, Todd. Go ahead.
That's great. This actually refers to earlier comments by your very informative correspondent. I was surprised, though, that she was referring to, in general, how peaceful the, quote, Arab, quote, spring was and is. Yes, in the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia, we could consider that very peaceful. Egypt was relatively peaceful, just hundreds dead. Certainly, Libya is a very violent revolution. Yemen is a very violent Arab revolution. Bahrain was very violent. And, of course, Syria is a complete series of atrocities. So the way I calculate it, to call it spring, the Arab Spring was not a peaceful, in general, and in whole, it was not, I consider, a very peaceful revolution.
Yeah, at least it hasn't turned out that way. Dina, what do you think? Thanks a lot, Todd.
I think in the early days of it, I think when it got the moniker Arab Spring, which is kind of a moniker that stuck as opposed to a moniker that's particularly accurate, I think in the beginning it was fairly peaceful. I think that what we're seeing now is sort of post-Arab Spring shakeout. And I, for example, I don't particularly think of Syria as being Arab Spring. Yemen, I also don't really see that as being Arab Spring. Their president, Saleh, stepped down really almost before the Arab Spring happened. There were issues with Saleh, and then it was sort of negotiated out after that. And while Yemen is not peaceful, Yemen is not on is not as violent as what we're seeing, for example, in Syria or what we saw in Libya. I think for the most part, what happened in Libya until the time that Muammar Gaddafi fell, I think that there was sort of a wrangling, but I'm not sure that I thought it was an all-out war. I think now what you're having is everybody trying to see what piece of the pie they can get, and that process has been incredibly violent. I completely agree with you. And I guess if I was king and they would allow me to rename the Arab Spring, I would not rename it that. I might rename it something like the Arab uprisings, which I think is much more accurate. But certainly in the beginning, it seemed like spring.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, your point is well taken. I'm not sure I would lump Syria in with that stuff. I think that's really and truly a civil war. But your point is well taken.
Yeah, and I appreciate what he's saying because it does, in our sort of quick analysis, headline-y, you know, media shorthand type of world, it does all get lumped together. Even if it isn't the same thing.
It's not. You know, there was a really interesting story that I did about Google Trends and the Arab Spring. And, you know, the intelligence community was beating itself up that it didn't see the Arab Spring coming. So one of the things that it's looking at now is trying to figure out how it can use sort of social media, big data, that sort of thing, to try and figure out what is animating people on the ground. Because the intelligence community is incredibly good at listening to bad guys, but not that good at listening to what's going on the ground. So there was a researcher at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center who decided to look at what was animating people in Egypt just before the so-called Arab Spring. And what he did is he decided to look what their Google searches were. And their Google searches in the run-up to the Arab Spring were all about Tunisia. Now, remember, it started in Tunisia where a fruit vendor actually self-immolated himself because of corruption, and that started the whole ball rolling. Well, they were more interested. They were searching more for what was going on in Tunisia than they were the Egyptian version of Brad Pitt. Now, we know here in the United States, the way Google Trends can be very, very helpful is during the flu epidemic, the swine flu epidemic, I'm trying to remember when it was now, 2007, 2008, the way they were able to tell where there would be outbreaks is that people were Googling flu symptoms just before there'd be an outbreak in a particular area.
Because they were feeling a little funny.
And said, I wonder if I have the flu.
Yeah.
And that ended up anticipating where these outbreaks would come within, more than a week ahead of the CDC. So there is something to this. It's just it's unclear what it is.
Well, Todd, thanks for joining us. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And in Berlin, Josh is on the line. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura, and hello to you guys. I just wanted to say that it just seems that each successive administration, whether it's Democrat or Republican, keeps expanding the war to greater and greater proportions. And I've noticed there's a trend since World War One. They said that 10% of the casualties in World War One were civilian. Now it's up to 90% civilian. And there's a disconnect here with our society that this is the government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And it seems ever increasingly the executive branch is adding, through executive orders, dictatorial powers to the point where our Constitution is being eroded in the guise of protecting us. And also it seems as we're backing sides over there that a little better than mercenaries or radicals that leave a vacuum on stable governments, whether they're perfect or not. They were still stable governments, and they were governments that we could work with and kept relatively stability and security in those regions.
Josh, so I'm hearing from you, you feel like it's too easy these days for the president to just declare war and go do whatever he wants.
Well, not just that, Laura, but I also feel that sometimes war can be a distraction, and I'll leave it with this, is that war can also be used when the economy is turning bad, as it obviously is, irregardless of what the statistics is telling us. I think eventually they're setting the stage for a much wider war that could ultimately push the Chinese and the Russians to the point where they're going to get sick and tired of maybe not us personally, but certain agendas and certain military industrial complexes that we were warned about by Eisenhower. And we really, as Americans, should really, really take note and sit up and start protesting.
Well, Josh, thanks a lot for calling in. And lots of thoughts there, Dina. One thing that he mentioned that I did want to pick up on, how the U.S., as he put it, chooses sides. It's an excellent point in a lot of these conflicts, Syria, Mali, Libya. This has been a key question for the Obama administration. Who do you side with? Who do you help? How much do you help?
I think they've been actually one of their problems is they haven't chosen sides. And that's why there's so much ambiguity. So in the case of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, I think that it was pretty clear that he needed to step down. They have sort of chosen sides in the Assad case. I've said he should step down, but they don't know what's going to replace him. So they've been kind of careful about that. It's interesting that the caller says this now because what a lot of people are talking about now with the Obama administration and their new national security team is that it has actually gone a different direction, that the national security team in the past was slightly more hawkish. And that the new national security team, let's take, for example, Chuck Hagel, if he's actually confirmed as Secretary of Defense, he was against the Iraq war. So the sense is, now, of course, he hasn't assembled his whole team yet. We're still trying to figure out who those people are going to be. But the sense is that he's actually having a much more dovish team that is going to be advising him. I mean, the new thing we're hearing this morning is that McDonough, who was one of his national security advisors, is going to be, and a key foreign policy advisor, is going to be his chief of staff. That sort of is a signal of what he intends to do in the next 4 years. We'll see if that actually happens. But that's – I think that we should not necessarily hold judgment, but let's see what the team looks like and then try and assess where they're going to go after that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it does relate to Josh's concern that it's just too easy for the U.S. to get involved in all these conflicts. Thanks, Josh, for that call. Here's an email from Jack. He says, great conversation. Does your reporting, Dina, ever put you at personal risk? Jack, I'm so glad you asked that question because Dina told us some great stories last night at UNH School of Law. Great in that you escaped, Dina, but you did talk about the extreme measures that you sometimes have to go through to make sure you don't get killed or kidnapped while covering places like Pakistan or Iraq. So, Jack, thanks for the call. Couple things that came out last night. Number one, NPR foreign reporters don't have big security details. How come?
Or security details.
Any security details.
I want to be a little bit careful about this because I don't particularly want to say everything we do from a security perspective. But let me put it this way. We do not travel with armed guards. And some networks do. Some other organizations travel with armed guards. And this is not to cast aspersions on their decision to do that. But there has been an affirmative decision at NPR that if we're traveling with armed guards, we're adding to the conflict. And that is not what we're there to do. And also, to a large extent, we are trying to find out what's going on the ground. We're not trying to find out the U.S. version of what's going on the ground. We're actually talking to regular Iraqis or regular Pakistanis to try and figure out what's going on the ground. And armed guards don't really – they aren't conducive to that. So what we do is we try to report smart. And you can do that by sort of having second cars placed places. You can do that by making sure you go in with somebody who really knows the terrain well, like a local journalist or a local fixer who, for example, knows Swat Valley really well and therefore can tell us you can go here, but I heard from a villager that there was a skirmish over here, so let's go over there. So there are ways to do it. You can't minimize the danger completely, but you can be smart about it. And we have a security team in Washington that we talk when we're going to do something a little dicey. We talk to them. What I do versus what somebody like Kelly McEvers, who was just in Syria, does, and what Lourdes Garcia Navarro, Lulu, did in Iraq and Libya. It makes me feel like I'm on training wheels. They've got the big mountain bikes. They're doing the big mountain bike stuff, and I'm doing the training wheel stuff comparatively.
Well, still, some of the stories last night, real interesting. And you talked about the soft car versus the hard car as one of those security measures that you take. What are those? What are those for, Dina?
A soft car, it looks like a car that anybody is driving. We used to have soft cars in we had a beat-up Corolla, basically what you give your 16-year-old kid as his first car. That's what we had as a soft car. And then we had an armored BMW. And so, for example, when they came to pick you up at the airport, which at the time in 2008, there was a lot of snipers around the airport. When they came to pick you up at the airport, you put on a Kevlar vest and you were in the BMW and you drove out because there was sort of a sniper alley there. But I did a story on women drivers and in Iraq and Baghdad in 2008, and there were a lot of kidnappings going on. So what we did is we pre-positioned the hard car, and I went into this neighborhood where the school bus driver was in a soft car, so I wouldn't attract any attention. And the hard car, which was not far from the school, which basically I walked to, we had a driver sort of reading a newspaper looking like he was waiting for his Iraqi boss to come out of the house and drive him to his next appointment. So that's the kind of stuff that we do.
Right. So you arrive in one car and leave in another.
Sometimes. Soft car, hard car. Yeah, you sort of you mix it up. So you just make it a little bit harder. Look, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're doomed. There's nothing you can do. But you try and minimize being in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's what you do.
And you're covered.
So in Iraq, we wore a hijab and abaya. They don't in Afghanistan, when I've reported there, I wear a burqa, which is the blue thing, which, by the way, you cannot see through. I'm convinced that the reason why we always see women in burqas with children, you know, holding children's hands, is because they're seeing-eyed children. Because you really, you trip all over the place wearing a burqa. They're also hot. They're made of polyester, and they're really hot. And then in Pakistan, I would just wear a shalwar chemise, which is sort of this long tunic-like shirt that the women and the men wear, and then a scarf over my head. But I'm blonde, and I have blue eyes, so there's only...
there's only so much you can do
there.
There's
only so much I can do, yeah.
You also talked last night about the 10-minute rule, the 10-minute security rule. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I'm not sure that applies in Iraq anymore. But in 2008, basically the idea was that you had 10 minutes to gather as much tape as you could before people who wanted to do you harm, i.e. kidnap you, would be able to make enough cell phone calls to get everybody together and grab you. So I remember once I went to a suicide bombing that had occurred, and that you always wait for the second blast because there's always two. So what happens is there's a suicide bombing, and then usually they plan 10, 15 minutes. They wait for the first responders to come in and the Good Samaritans come in, and then they blow up more.
That's so cruel. I mean, it's so cruel to do one and then to plan it that way.
Yeah, exactly. So we always wait for the second one. And I'd never been to a suicide bombing before. And this was in a sort of open marketplace. And I remember in this particular instance, I was doing something for Morning Edition, and I didn't want to get something very bloody. We try not to have sort of really tough stuff on in the morning in that respect, like gory details and that sort of thing. So, but I wanted to do this story on the suicide bombing. There was a woman there who was selling makeup, and she was just wailing and crying and everything. It turns out that the suicide bomber was standing right next to her. So the blast zone was essentially just away from her. So she could see everything, but she wasn't really affected. And she was sobbing, and I said, well, so what happened? Tell me what it was like. And I was sort of in the back of my mind thinking, I hope it's not gory. And she said, there was a woman in front of me with a baby, and she went up in the air, and she never came down.
Oh.
And I thought that was actually one of the most amazing descriptions of what happens during a suicide bombing that I'd ever heard. And it isn't gory, but it sort of, it sums it all up.
It says it, doesn't it?
It sums it all up, yeah.
You know, Dina, obviously your work is determined by the news cycle, by what's happening in counterterrorism. We talked about Algeria earlier. But if you could just take a few days, catch your breath, cover this beat in terms of a story that you really want to dig into, not so much dictated by, you know, the headlines in the news of the day, what would you dig into?
Now, see, you asked me earlier if there was any one question. I wouldn't want you to ask me it. And I think that would probably be it because
really?
I'd give it to somebody. It's because somebody would say, oh, I'll do this story. So I hesitate to do that. I will say that over the next year, you know, when we plan for the next year, I have this fabulous editor, Bruce Oster, who's the national security editor, and we decide what we're going to do over the next year. I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff about big data and intelligence, and I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff about drone policy.
Yeah.
So that's what you should stay tuned for, but I'm not going to be any more specific than that because I want to save these stories for our listeners.
Right. Well, fair enough, Dina. And again, thank you so much for being with us here on NHPR and for coming to New Hampshire. Thank you so much.
You bet. It's beautiful, like the snow.
Dina Temple-Raston, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent. Again, she's in the state this week kicking off the Justice and Journalism Lecture Series hosted by NHPR and UNH Law. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.